The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition. EDU standing for education, where we pick one topic and dive a little bit deeper than we normally would in our Q&A show, which you can always find on your favorite podcast outlet. That would be the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. This being the EDU edition, today we picked a topic that was actually prompted by a listener email that was asking us about safe withdrawal rates and if it's low enough, if we think that it would still be okay to use that approach. That was the gist of the question. So we have talked previously on the show about safe withdrawal rates and our like and dislike of that approach, mostly dislike. But we thought we'd take this show and explain why we approach things the way we do and try to answer this question from this listener the best that we can.
Okay. Well, hello, folks. My name is Jim Salnier. I'm a certified financial planner here in the fine state of Colorado. That previous voice you heard was Chris Stein, also a certified financial planner and finance instructor at Colorado State University. He actually, what's your director?
Director of the Financial Planning Program.
Director of the Financial Planning Program. Mm-hmm. So your title is director.
Sure.
Okay. So that voice you just heard was Chris Stein, the director of the Financial Planning Program at Colorado State University. Together, we make up Jim Salnier and Associates. I am Jim. He's the associate.
We have others, too.
We have others, yeah.
Scott, another associate, just wandered in.
Who just walked in.
He's going to stare at us while we record.
Yes.
Joe is an associate.
Joe just left.
I would count her as an associate.
Scott is the newest associate.
We have Rob, Mitchell, and Shannon, and Laura, and another Joe. There's a whole pack of associates here.
There's a whole pack of... how do you abbreviate associates?
What?
Just want to point out what you all might be.
Associates? I don't know. It's already after. It's already plural.
All right.
There's one associate, multiple associates.
Okay.
So you were thinking ahead when you said when you named the business Jim Salnier and Associates. Because at the time it was just you.
True.
And maybe one assistant.
I had an assistant, so there was an associate.
Yeah.
Okay, but what we want to do is get to this listener's question here on the EDU show. And I think
Wow, that's a nice start.
I could spend a long time on this, and I don't want to because I know you can't stay late. And I think the listener is going to be surprised with some of what we have to say, but I also am going to want him to look at things a little bit different than the way he's writing it. So I'm going to begin. He is an Arizonian.
Mm-hmm.
And did you see it snowed there?
I did. My wife was just down there, and she was talking about how cold it was. Then it snowed, yeah.
Yeah, now I know it snows all the time in that Flagstaff area.
Way south. Like
that's
in
what I mean.
Southern Arizona.
It was way down there, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the cactus were covered in snow. Mm-hmm. But weird. Okay, it begins. Hi, Jim and Chris. I found your podcast a couple of months ago. I live in Arizona, by the way, and have been thoroughly enjoying your EDU and Q&A discussions. My question is about a withdrawal strategy. I understand your safety first philosophy, per Wade Fowes' terminology, and that is Wade Fowes' terminology, mm-hmm. So I wonder if he read Wade's book or not.
Must have, yeah, some connection.
I understand your safety-first philosophy per Wade Fowes' terminology, and for those listeners who don't know, Wade Fowes is actually Professor Wade Fowes of the American College he's at, isn't he? I believe he's
now
the American
he is,
College.
Yeah, in Pennsylvania.
Yep, mm-hmm. The American College in Pennsylvania, which is a leader in the financial planning industry. And Wade, Professor Pfau, is huge, huge in retirement distribution planning.
Yes.
He's one of the leading thought minds and academics in retirement distribution planning. So I understand your safety-first philosophy per Wade Pfau's terminology, minimum dignity floor, which is our terminology, not Professor Pfau's, and using Social Security / annuities for those basic needs. I don't disagree with that approach at all. However, my question is, what amount of withdrawal rate would you be comfortable with if I chose not to use guaranteed income sources? You mentioned in your latest podcast, and this email was from over a month ago, so I'm not sure what pod, it would have been a podcast from about 5-6 weeks ago now. You mentioned in the latest podcast that the safe withdrawal rate these days is around 3%. And yes, I do remember mentioning that. That came from Wade Pfau, Professor Pfau, and Harvard University. Harvard has it at 2.8. Wade has it as a little over 3, so I just rounded to 3.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume I have
Let's stop right there. Let's, for our listeners who might be new or newer, safe withdrawal rate refers to a calculation for how much you can withdraw from your assets that you've saved for retirement, how much you can draw out every year and have the chance of you running out of money be extraordinarily low. It's never quite zero, but it can get really close to zero, very, very low chance at certain withdrawal rates when we run lots of simulations trying to predict what kinds of returns we're going to experience throughout retirement while withdrawing this money that we've determined. And there was a study, boy, this is what, 15 years ago now?
1993, Bill Benjamin.
1993, so that's even longer than I thought. 93 now, that he had come to the conclusion that 4% was the number that you could safely withdraw 4% and increase it for inflation over time. So maintaining your lifestyle and have the chance of you running out of money be extraordinarily small. So then a lot of people did some math to figure out, okay, if I want to live on $50,000 a year, if that's going to be 4% of my portfolio, how much am I going to need? And that's then my target for saving. And it kind of seemed to make saving for retirement a simple mathematical process. But over time, we've seen some weaknesses kind of rear their head in that approach. So
we'll get into that.
So I just wanted to define for people, not assume everybody knew what that meant.
Absolutely. I'm going to get into that.
Okay.
So he continues, let's assume I had a 60-40 stock portfolio, and that would be a 60-40 stock to bond allocation. And what he means by that is 60% in equities, 40% in fixed income, which is traditionally termed a moderate portfolio.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
With a broadly diversified portfolio. Let's say I am earning 3% interest from bonds and a little over 2% in dividends from my stocks. Would you be comfortable with a 2.5% withdrawal rate? I will be mostly living off of my dividends and interest, and hence I feel I can handle the volatility of the portfolio, when he's talking about his moderate portfolio. And if not 2.5%, would you be comfortable with 2? He keeps going down. How would your answer change if I am planning on living 40 years in retirement as opposed to a current 30-year retirement? I'm just wondering where your line is. And if I don't want to use income annuities, since I will still have Social Security, keep up the great work. Mm-hmm. I liked his question.
I like it too.
I don't necessarily agree. Well, he's not making any claims, so I'm not going to say I don't agree with him. I am going to encourage him to still look at some point in time considering some guarantees. And let me explain why Chris and I have come up with our approach and why we do it, listener. But before I get into that, let's attack his questions on the safe withdrawal rate. Chris already talked about the safe withdrawal rate being around for a long time. Came out in 1993, folks, by a gentleman named Bill Benjen. Bill was, and I don't know the man personally. I've heard him talk. I've read about him. I saw him once, but I didn't say anything to him. Bill was a numbers geek, probably still is. And he was not a financial planner originally, which most people getting into this industry don't start off in college. Now they do. But years ago, in the 80s and 90s, you generally didn't go to college, Chris, and study financial planning. You kind of stumbled into it, much like I did. Today, you actually teach students this. Bill was, if I got this wrong, not that you're listening to the Retirement and IRA show, I doubt. I believe he was an engineer, which makes sense.
That's true.
Why he was crunching numbers. Mm-hmm. And when he talks and describes his safe withdrawal rate, it all came about, Chris, because of spreadsheets. When spreadsheets started coming out in the early 90s, he being a numbers geek, was really fixated on them. And we're not talking Excel. I think it was something else back then, Lotus 1-2-3 or something like that. He said when the first spreadsheet started coming out, he was on the side an investment geek. And he could get data from Morningstar. There was just no way to crunch it. But once spreadsheets came out, he started writing spreadsheet programs. And what he wanted to do was crunch the data that he could get from a lot of these data companies, Morningstar being one of them. And what he simply was starting to do on his own as he was crunching this data was he started to look at various returns of different asset classes. And in fact, his first approach to the 4% rule, which he didn't even know was going to be called the 4% rule because he didn't get a finding yet when he did it. His approach was to just look at historical data of what different asset classes, and it didn't even include small cap stocks when he first did it. I think the story goes he didn't have enough data numbers on those or something. And what he started doing is looking at different time periods, different historical rates of return, and different withdrawal rates adjusted for inflation. How much could he have taken out on a static way? There was no Monte Carlo variability built in back then. Just on a static approach, using his moderate portfolio, how much could be withdrawn before the portfolio reached zero? And then he graphed it. And the worst possible time, or worst possible initial withdrawal rate, put it that way, was 4.3%. The financial press rounded it down to 4. Sounded better, 4% rule than the 4.3% rule. And I believe it was 4.3. It might have been 4.2.
And what he did there is he found that at 4.3, he still would have, his portfolio would have lasted through the worst historical 30-year period or whatever he was running for retirement that had existed in the past. So he kind of ran these simulations using past data and just keep tweaking the number and finding the worst 30-year stretch for investments, for these types of investments, and say, if I was unlucky and I hit that bad stretch, how much could I have taken out and still not run out of money? And that's where the 4.3 came
Correct.
From.
Correct. And a lot of the other returns were a lot higher than 4%.
Right. Yeah.
So 4% became the worst, therefore it became the rule. But everybody listening knows past performance is no guarantee of future results. And to simply say, okay, in the past, and look at the time period. This was 1993. So he was crunching time periods from the 50s into the 80s. And those were very good times in the market, except for the 60s. The 60s had some issues going on there. But especially right after World War II, very powerful market rallies. And when his report came out in 93, Chris, not that Mr. Benjen knew, he was knee-deep halfway into one of the biggest bull markets in history. We had all through the rest of the 90s where this 4% rule looked brilliant because equities were earning double digits. Then the 2000s hit and we had a 50% loss in 3 years, followed by a 100% gain in five, followed by a 56, I think, top to bottom in the 07, 08 into early 09 correction, that 18-month correction. Followed by a break even, it took about 6 years for the markets to recover from that loss, and now we've been ahead since then. And it blew up the 4% rule. And spreadsheets have been greatly improved from where they were in 93. And software programs running what are known as Monte Carlo simulations, where they can run not just 30-year rolling periods, but hundreds, if not thousands, of what the industry calls iterations, different hypotheticals, different what-if scenarios, different rates of return and standard deviations. And you can start to draw even more conclusions and come up with more assumptions. And then people like Professor Wade Fowle and Harvard University and others started revisiting the 4% rule and simply lowered it by a quarter to the 3% rule. Just take out 25% less.
Right.
But something funny also happened over the last 10 years. The industry, including Professor Fowle, started waking up to the fact that the 4% rule or any safe withdrawal rule may not really be the best thing for retirement planning. And you hit the nail on the head not too long ago, Chris. And hopefully you remember where I'm going with this because
totally,
you said it.
Because I've been waiting to say it here.
Because failure is not just what Bill Benjamin figured, which was, well, if you don't take out more than 4%, you stand a better than average chance that in 30 years when you run out of life, you'll still have money. But failure should be measured another way.
Yeah, your lack of doing fun things that you could have afforded because you are on the other end of the distribution, we would call it. The distribution of outcomes, when you're talking about the future, you could be unlucky and end up on the negative side, and that's where Bill was really focused on, gee, in the worst case scenario, when I'm out on what we call the left tail, right, which is the bad end of the distribution, the bad end of the outcomes, 4.3% was his conclusion that as long as I stuck to that, if the bad happens, I'm on the left-hand side here on the bad end of the spectrum, I'm still going to be okay. Won't have much, if anything, left at the end, but I will make it through without running out of money while I'm still living, assuming I live about what I predict. But there's just as much chance that you could end up on the positive end of this, way to the right-hand side, the positive tail, which means you're going to end up with tons of money at the end when you die. And I made the point a while back that in my eyes, that's just as much of a failure as the other end.
Exactly.
And using this withdrawal rate, essentially you're not exposing yourself just to one side of this distribution. You're exposing yourself to the whole thing. And once you determine you have fill in the blank percentage chance of you running out on one end, you have a certain chance and oftentimes an equal chance. And I just read an article by Michael Kitsis that just came out on this exact thing where he pointed it out. He was focused on sequence of returns. If your sequence of returns rolls in your favor, you could end up with huge amounts of money at the end that you didn't intend to. Again, in my eyes, and maybe I'm convincing you, failure.
Oh, you don't have to say you're convincing me. I've always believed that. That's part of what we came up with our process for.
So the goal should be, I want to be able to spend as much as possible enjoying myself and not run out of money. Not spend the minimum amount that I'm allowed to so that I'm sleeping well at night knowing that the chances of me running out of money are very low. If you take one approach, you're going to expose yourself to that other kind of failure, which is sitting at home doing nothing when you could be doing lots of fun stuff.
And that's what I want to talk about because academics, Professor Fowle being one of them, and institutions, Morningstar being one of them. I talked how I went to the Retirement Income Summit last year, Chris, and Morningstar's David Blanchett was there talking about Morningstar's study finding the same thing, that a safe withdrawal rate unnecessarily exposes you to living too conservatively. And they're waking up to the fact, Chris, we die. And they're waking up to the fact that you're going to go through go-go, slow-go, no-go phases of retirement, which I wish I created those terminologies. I didn't. Another financial planner did. I forget what his name
is. We make up some of our own. We take some of the other ones we hear.
Minimum dignity floor is mine. It's not as good as go-go, slow-go, no-go. No, I love that
one. I like that one, too.
Yeah. But we often tell our clients, your go-go, slow-go, no-go phase applies only to your fund spending. It does not apply to your minimum dignity floor items, those certain level of items that you need to cover for the rest of your life, whether you have money or not. And that's where the exposure to the right side, as Chris said, of the scale comes in. That's why there is a safe withdrawal rate. That's why Bill Benjamin came up with it. He didn't come up with it to make sure an 80-year-old can go salmon fishing in Alaska, which is what I would want to do at 80. Mm-hmm. He came up with a safe withdrawal rate to make sure that 80-year-old can afford a roof over their head, afford food, utilities, mm-hmm. health care, transportation. Mm-hmm. So because he said, you're going to need all of those and you're going to need money, don't take out more than 4% and you should have enough. But the problem is that limits you during your early retirement years of your 60s generally. I know a lot of do-it-yourselfers listening to this podcast want to retire in their 50s if they could. But during that initial phase of retirement, it limits you, Chris, to saying, okay, in order to make sure the 80, 90-year-old me, if they're even around, has enough money to cover their food, utilities, housing, transportation, and health care, I'm only going to spend this little bit of money on fun things because mm-hmm. I can't take out more without the risk of outliving that. I think that is the silliest, stupidest way of approaching retirement. I'm sorry, folks, I do. Because this is the only life we have and we know how retirement ends. We don't get younger, stronger, and healthier. I talk openly about my best friend who died 3 years ago next month. You know him. You met him a few times. Mm-hmm. His name was Rob. Rob and I had known each other for 17 years. And one day he told me he didn't feel right anymore. Felt out of tired too soon. 3 weeks later, he called me and told me he had 6 months to live. And he lived 5. He was 47. At any time, what happened to Rob can happen to any of us. And your ability to go and do things is gone forever, eternity. I am not going to live my retirement, Chris, limiting my ability to go hiking, hunting, fishing, and whatever it else is I want to do in my 60s to 4% of my portfolio.
And going off and doing a bunch of fun stuff sounds great and justified doing it while you're healthy, absolutely. But then the worry is, what if I get out of control and I spend too much and then I jeopardize my ability to just basically live when I get into my 80s and maybe 90s or beyond if I live that long? That's where our process fixes that. You've got that minimum dignity floor covered, leaving the rest of what you have able to for you to spend and blow as fast as you want to do it. Everybody's different. Some people want to do a ton of stuff and realize, you know, there'll be a lot less of this fun stuff later, but I really want to do it now when I can enjoy it with my family and my grandchildren and whatever. Other people want to kind of spread it out. But the point is, it gives you the freedom, gives you permission to spend your own money to have fun, knowing that this safety net, this bottom dignity floor that we call it, is in place. And the only way to create that and give you total permission to spend on the fun stuff the way you see fit is with secure income. That's the problem. If you leave it subject to investments, then we're back in the randomness of what's happening with returns and the possibility you get unlucky and you really needed to save more. You want to offload that basic risk elsewhere. And that's what you're doing when you're relying upon Social Security. They're taking the risk that you live too long. They're going to pay you if you live to 100 because they didn't have to pay somebody else who only lived to 65. That works that way. You offload that risk. You buy an annuity from an insurance company.
Or a pension from your employer.
Or a pension from your employer. Those are the key secure income sources we talk about. The risk of you living too long isn't on you. It's been offloaded to those who can afford to pay it.
Well, it's been a group. A pension, Social Security, and an annuity is a group. I used to use an analogy that I haven't used in a long time. That an annuity, a pension, or Social Security is a herd of zebras on the Serengeti.
I haven't heard this one for a while.
But it's true. And safe withdrawal rate investment-only approach is one zebra on the Serengeti. Now you've got a herd of tens of thousands of zebras over here, Chris, on the left, on the right. You've got one zebra on the Serengeti. And in front of you...
Here come the lions.
Here come the lions. Now, if you are one of 10,000 zebras and some lions came up, you start running with all the other zebras. That's why zebras herd. That's why fish school. It's a protection mechanism. One zebra is going to go down. Those lions are going to get one. There's no disputing it there. It's just that you, as a zebra, have a pretty darn good chance of it being someone else. Whereas if it's just you and your money, and you're trying to fund your retirement with just your money, and you're not going to pool that risk with other zebras, if it's just you on the Serengeti and that pride of hungry lions happens to come by, guess which zebra's going down, Chris? Mm-hmm.
Well, you might get lucky and you get away. We see it on YouTube or Mutual of Omaha or whatever. Every once in a while, one of them gets away. So if you have performance in your investments that happens to outpace the lions, good for you. But the chances of you going down is much higher. And much scarier, much more frantic, and you have to play it so much safer. You have to hide behind the bushes. You have to sneak away from the lions. You got to do all that kind of stuff. Where if you're in the herd, you just eat away happily and then run when it's appropriate, and most likely somebody else is going to get it.
Right. If you're in the herd.
I mean, if we want to take this metaphor to its extreme, that's kind of, you can talk about the emotional state of these two zebras. One in the herd with the comfort, knowing that the chances of getting eaten by a lion is very low because they're off in that herd. Where the solitary zebra now has to do nothing but worry about being eaten by
always
a lion.
Always worried. Exactly. Always worried. I love that analogy. Well, I love my analogy.
Yeah. I
love you improving
it.
Yeah. You improved my analogy. But Chris is right. When you're trying to fund your retirement alone, you're always going to be worried. I always tell people, Chris, when you retire, it is going to freak you out. And I kid you not, folks. As you retire and you know that's it, there's no more money coming in, and you start watching your portfolio dropping, and you start seeing it going down, either because of withdrawals or because of market losses, and you know you're not working anymore, it's going to freak you out. Right now, most of you who are listening are do-it-yourselfers, or you wouldn't be listening to the Retirement and IRA show. Right now, most good do-it-yourselfers, Chris, who are still working, they know market drops are generally temporary if you're in a well-diversified, low-cost, well-allocated portfolio. And they can handle that a lot better than a lot of other people. But it changes, folks. You may think you have high risk tolerance now when you're working and actually saving and investing. Losses in the market are quote-unquote buying opportunities, as Wall Street calls it. Not when you're retired. Chris just alluded to an article from Michael Kitsis, who's just brilliant, very smart man. Mm-hmm. Not a professor, but he might as well be. And he talks all the time about sequential risk, and so does Professor Pfau. all the time on sequential risk. And sequential risk is just the timing of your retirement being at an inopportune time with a market loss. When the market loss happens, Chris, it's going to freak you out. Mm-hmm. You're that lone zebra, always worried, where's the lion, where's the lion? Because if a lion comes, I am screwed. Well, when you optimize your Social Security, keep your pension instead of taking a lump sum payout, or purchase an income annuity instead of hiring Ken Fisher, Mr. I Hate Annuities, and so should you, because he is not going to give you, though. Talk to Ken. You never get a hold of him, but talk to his minions. Just say, will you guarantee me, no matter how long I live, the money you are managing for me will never run out if I'm withdrawing X amount a year? They're not going to give that guarantee.
They shouldn't ever give it.
They can't.
But if that withdrawal percentage was low enough, they could say with a really high degree of confidence, but then they're generating that other failure for you.
Exactly.
They're saying you're going to be so clenched up not spending any money, only spending 1% or some ridiculously low amount, you're going to die with a whole lot of fun left behind.
And investment advisors think that's winning. They do.
Yeah.
Because when you look at an investment advisor trying to compare taking some of your money and passing it on, not being that lone zebra on the Serengeti, instead herding up with 10,000 other zebras for protection of the pool, because some zebra's going to go down and that's going to protect you. Well, when you pool your money with pensions, Social Security, and income annuities, some people are going to die before you and help you. That's how it works. When you do it all on your own, and yes, Chris, you hit the nail on the head again, and you work with an investment advisor who turns around and says, well, no, we can't fully guarantee, but you have a 90, 95, 99% chance of not outliving your money if you just withdraw this small amount. To me, they miss the boat. Mm-hmm. On what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be consuming your assets, not dying with it, just to leave it to someone who's just going to turn around and spend it, and not you. And you're going to leave it to your children as well. They should get some. I'm not saying don't leave them anything. Or you're going to leave it to a charity or to the government in taxes, but you're not going to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And then an investment advisor will say, Chris, oh, well, look it, you don't want the annuity because when you die, that's it, the money is gone. You want us because if you live, notice they don't say if you die, if you live, you're going to have this pool of investment money left over. At least with ours, yeah, you're going to die, it's gone. But you spent it, hopefully. Mm-hmm. You didn't just leave it sitting there. You died after you spent it. Whereas with them, you died and you never spent it, so you never got to do what you wanted to do. So when he says, how about if he lowers his withdrawal rate to 2% or 2.5%, mm-hmm. would we be fine? If you, listener, have enough millions upon millions upon millions of dollars that you can take 2% of it a year,
and do everything you ever
wanted
to do.
And do everything you want to do, I'm fine with it.
Yeah. So we can come around to that way of thinking in an extreme example. But otherwise, if you're worried about your retirement, which means you don't have oodles and oodles and oodles of money, more money than you could ever spend, I'm happy for you if you're in that situation. Most people are not. You don't want to look at it that way. You don't want to try to restrict yourself to that percentage. You might increase your chances to the extreme that you won't run out of money, but you're also increasing your chances that you're going to do way less than you otherwise could have. And talk about regrets.
Yep.
The memories you could leave behind for your family, even. You miss all that stuff.
And remember, listeners, with the safe withdrawal rate, it assumes both your expenses are going to move at a methodical level and rate throughout retirement. Only your minimum dignity floor does. Your minimum dignity floor, at least this is our verbiage and we created it, it's five areas: food, utilities, transportation, which is the maintenance, upkeep, and replacement of one vehicle, housing, and healthcare. Those are your minimum dignity floor items. And Chris, you will agree, those items, you're still going to need food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare at 65, 70, 75, 80, 85, 90. And those expenses are going to steadily increase, but they're always going to be there. But your fun expenses, the ones that we're talking about unnecessarily constraining to this quote-unquote safe withdrawal rate under this misguided notion that the 80-year-old you is going to spend as much on fun expenses, or the 85-year-old or the 90-year-old, as the 55, 60, 65-year-old. And that doesn't happen. You will age and you will slow down. And what is fun for a 60, 65-year-old is no longer enjoyable for an 80, 85-year-old. And what an 80, 85-year-old would do, a 60-year-old would find boring. But an 80, 85-year-old's going to love it. Now, there's always, always tail-end exemptions to this. You'll always know that one person who's 85 and just climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. But the fact of the matter is, most people are not going to do that.
Right.
So what I try to get people to understand is your fun spending will definitely go through a go-go, slow-go, no-go phase. And during your go-go phase, I want you to spend money. That's generally speaking 6 to 10 years, each phase lasts, unless you retire early. Then your go-go phase could be even longer.
Mm-hmm.
But your slow go and no go phase are very similar, and you may skip slow go. I can't tell you the number of people I work with, folks, who skip slow go.
Right, from go go to no go.
And it's sad because it's health driven.
Mm-hmm.
I see it all the time. We have hundreds of clients. We see it. People who 1 year are fine, next year they're telling us, it's done. I got this, or this happened to me, or that. Or this, that, or the other thing happened to my wife. It's changed. Their priorities change. And their ability to go do what they always enjoy doing is gone forever. And what they generally will say, we have the memories. Or they say, they got the regrets. I should have spent the money while I could have. Now I have this money, and it's not going to do me any good. So we just, that's why we believe in this, folks. And for that listener, you didn't give me dollar amounts. You didn't say, hey, look, I am going to be able to fund all the fun things I want to do during my go-go years. No problem with a 2.5% withdrawal rate. If you really are that blessed and have that much in assets or that low of a cost of living, then sure, you're okay, you can live off of that quote-unquote safe withdrawal rate. But pay attention to what Chris and I are saying. We only believe in covering your minimum dignity floor with lifetime guaranteed secure income. Fun spending, that can be at the whim of the markets. And we'll teach you through bucketing how to spend when your assets are at the whim of the markets for your fun spending. But if you ran out of money, if things didn't work out, Chris, the markets crash, taxes rise, inflation goes through the roof, and your portfolio is running out of money far faster than you're running out of life, at least under ours, you still have that minimum dignity floor protected. And that's why we call it the minimum dignity floor. It's not to live on rice and beans, which is what an Itunian once said to me. They misunderstood our minimum dignity floor. It is designed by you to replicate the food, the utilities, the car, the house, and the health care you want to receive and you have grown accustomed to. But if that has been herded up, if that's the zebra herd, then these occasional lions coming by, you may be able to dodge that. But you could then put your fun spending as that lone lion on the Serengeti. Because if it runs out, all is not lost. You still have the minimum dignity floor.
Yep.
That's why we believe in it. So he asked, are we comfortable if it was a 2%? Sure. But I don't want you sacrificing and saying, I don't like it when people in their 60s say, well, we're going to wait for the portfolio to come back and then we're going to go do that. We're going to give it a few years because we may not have it. I think about this all the time. I'm 55. I know I have about 5 years before, well, not about, I have 5 years before I'm 60. And my life changes at that point because I don't want to do this forever. And I want to start enjoying myself for that last decade to 12-year period, all through my 60s into my early 70s when I'm really in a good go-go phase. Then I'll enter hopefully slow-go, which will take me into my early 80s and then into my no-go, which is not hospice. It's what my dad is right now. He plays cards. He plays bingo. He goes out to breakfast. He doesn't really do much beyond that, Chris. That's no-go. We're going through those phases. Mm-hmm. But I have no intention personally to limit the amount of salmon fishing and elk hunting that I'm going to do in my 60s because Wall Street crashes and took my portfolio with it. I'm going to position my assets through bucketing to be able to cover my go-go phase. I'm going to have my minimum dignity floor protected, and I'm going to spend my damn money because I can't take it with me.
Perfect. Well, I think we sufficiently answered his question, probably a little more emotionally and animated than he was expecting. But this really strikes at the essence of what we do here and how we've evolved to the things that we do. So if this has struck a chord with you, if you're interested in finding more about this, maybe you haven't listened to the show for a long time, but you happen to listen to this one, this does kind of get down to the heart of the matter of our approach to retirement planning, which is our specialty. Reach out to us. We are living, breathing financial planners in Northern Colorado, although we help people all over the country through this fabulous new invention called the internet. And if you'd like to chat with us, we offer what's called a coffee and a second opinion, where you can get with us over the phone. We can talk about your situation and try to determine between both of us if there's something we can help you out with and make your planning, make your future a little bit more under your own control and laid out in the way you'd like to see it than maybe it is without this type of a plan.
And the one thing I do want to point out with that, our business model is unique. Most of you are do-it-yourselfers and you don't want anyone to manage your assets. We don't have to manage your assets. That makes our firm very unique. You pay us for our time. You want a retirement plan or a tax projection analysis or a bucketing plan or an income plan, you simply pay us a fee for whatever plan you want. What you do with the advice is up to you. How you implement the advice, who you hire to help you implement the advice is all up to you. So that sets our firm apart from most firms out there. So don't hesitate to reach out. Give us a call if you think we can be of a help. And one more thing before, I know you're going to kill me, to that listener with his question, one thing we didn't mention, and we always do. Not only will your spending go through go-go, slow-go, and no-go, your ability to understand financial concepts will also begin to diminish as you age. Like it or not, this is the truth. Chris and I talk openly of studies from Harvard University and Texas Tech University. Also two leaders. Harvard doesn't need any introduction. Texas Tech, leader in the financial planning industry. Mm-hmm. They wanted to know why elderly people were victims of financial abuse and financial fraud. We won't bore you with the studies, but according to Harvard University, the human brain, the part of our brain that understands financial concepts, is one of the last to develop and first to degrade. And when they graded it, it was a bell curve. And the pinnacle age is age 53 for us to be at our peak of understanding financial concepts. That's no surprise why the majority of people who hire us, Chris, are in their 50s. Doesn't surprise me at all. They're at that peak of understanding financial concepts. But Harvard also found after age 53, and I'm 55, and Chris isn't quite there. No, you're not there yet.
I'm reaching the pinnacle soon.
You're reaching 53 soon. I'm not as dumb as a brick because I'm 2 years past that, but I'm also not naive to know. 20 years from now, I'm not going to be the leader of this firm, if I'm even still associated with this firm. This firm is a company not going anywhere, and younger employees will take it over. Younger employees who will be younger than Chris and I are right now. Why? Because they will still be able to understand financial concepts, and I won't be as sharp in my 70s and 80s. I'm not dumb. I know this is coming. So when you try to plan your entire retirement on always managing your assets and having safe withdrawal rates and watching diversification and asset allocation and rebalancing, y'all might be into it now, but there's going to come a point in time where you're not going to be. Don't lose sight of that as well. And that's where our approach, where you just have steady pension, steady optimized Social Security, and if need be, yes, we're going to say the four-letter word, steady guaranteed lifetime income from an annuity coming in, covering that minimum dignity floor, you don't have to worry if you're developing dementia or Alzheimer's, or your brain is just slowing down from normal aging, and you just don't get it anymore. And you just don't get into it. You just don't. It happens. So we forgot to mention that, and that's one other thing I want that listener to understand. Mm-hmm. He is always going to be needing to manage a portfolio, and someday you may not want to or may not be able to.
Right. Good point. Good additional point there. So if you're interested in that Coffee and a Second Opinion that I was mentioning, where we can chat, see if there's something we can do for you, just reach out on our website. JimHelps.com is the shortest way to get there. There's a variety of ways, actually, but that's the quickest and easiest. JimHelps, that's JimHelps.com. On there, you'll find a contact form and also the ability to just schedule an appointment, one of these Coffee and a Second Opinion meetings right on the website there. You can also call us on the phone number that you'll find there. It's 970-530-0556. For those of you who just want to call in, Laura can set you up with what you need there. What else was I going to say? We've pretty much talked about everything, so we'll be signing off now here on the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition. Hope you found this valuable, and we'll be back next week with a brand new show.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.